Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for putting together an absolutely fantastic meeting so far. I'm going to be giving you the perspective on progenitor or massive star evolution from the viewpoint of somebody who studies supernova remnants. Just to give these people their due, these are my collaborators, Herman Lee at Kyoto, Carlos Badenis, Pat Slane, Don Ellison, and Hiro Nagataki. All right, so. So this is a plot, I think it's a very enlightening plot that shows what supernova remnants are looking at versus supernova. And I think everybody in this room wrote a chapter for this handbook, it sounds like. So, and this is from our chapter, Carlos's and I chapter. And what I'm plotting here is the radius away from the progenitor as a function of circumstellar density and what you're actually sampling when you look at, say, a supernova versus supernova remnants, and these are all type 1a supernova remnants, but the idea is the same for core collapse. When you choose certain parameters for your circumstellar environment, you end up sampling different ages in the stellar evolution. The point, however, is that the supernova tend to sample things that are in the last 50 to 100 years of evolution, or possibly even shorter timescales, and the remnants will sample a much earlier phase of evolution. The problem, however, is that if you look in X-rays, which I'm going to primarily focus on X-rays have a really good memory, and that's because they do not cool efficiently. So if you heat something up to X-ray emitting temperatures, it's just going to sit there because the mean free path between collisions becomes very long, and it only cools adiabatically. So what do we want to do in general? Well, our goal is to compare something that looks like this back to a place or an evolutionary track on the HR diagram. This is the movie I should always show at the end. This is 50 years worth of evolution of Cas A. This was done with taking all the data that was sent to us by Sidney Vandenberg and then combining it together. The key point to take away from this particular movie is that telescopes have gotten better over the last 50 years. But also, what you can see is that there's a whole lot of information that's encoded in this particular object. You see knots of ejecta, you obviously see the blast wave expansion, and you see the reverse shock beginning to move into the ejecta and lighting it up. So this is basically what I just said in words. We want to look at specific qualities of an individual supernova remnant in order to infer properties of the progenitor and the progenitor's evolution. So what I'm going to do now is just highlight a couple cases. This again is Cas A. I don't need to go over this in too much detail. I assume everyone knows this, most of this. It's the youngest known galactic core collapse supernova remnant. This is an RGB image of Cas A. I'll just describe it briefly. The blue emission corresponds to non-thermal emission from accelerated electrons. These are radiating. These are TeV electrons. They're cooling on timescales of years, but they trace out the location of the blast wave. The green emission is emission from shocked silicon, sulfur, argon, basically intermediate mass elements. And the red emission is from either shocked circumstellar material, like down here, and sort of across the face and sort of this bar-like thing, or from shocked iron. This is iron 17 to iron 24, so it's around 1 keV. You also see some iron up here. Now we can use this information in the X-ray to infer properties of the progenitor's evolution. For instance, Van Vielen in 2009, he looked at the location of the forward and the reverse shock and said that in order to match the radii, azimuthally averaged radii, they require a short Wolf-Rayet phase from the progenitor before it exploded. And this ends up evacuating a small cavity that the star then explodes into. And I'm going to come back to that because it's important. Because that cavity actually will imprint itself on the thermodynamics of the remnant 300 years later. J.J. Lee and collaborators in 2014 basically looked at the X-ray temperature, so the electron temperature, at the forward shock as a function of, well, basically distance back from the forward shock. And they basically found that in order to match what they're observing, both in terms of the temperature and they looked at the emission measure, They looked at another quantity, which we call the ionization age, but I don't have that plot. They needed also a small cavity around the star before it exploded. Now, where that cavity came from is open to debate. It could have come from a Wolf-Rayet phase, or it could have come from binary interaction. The point is that it's there. Okay. So, Una Wang and Martin Laming did something similar. But they also looked at the ejecta, and they basically did a complete census of the ejecta in Cassie. And what they found is that the iron, and this is something we already kind of knew, but they found that Cassie produced around 0.1 to 0.15 solar masses of iron, and they argued that most of it was shocked already, and they produced these nice maps that said, this is where the iron is. Now, the modelers, we would like you to tell us why it's like this. Finally, I can't get away from Cassie without showing the recent new star result, which when this first came out, of course, there was some hand-wringing and consternation about the fact that the titanium, which is shown in blue here, doesn't line up with the iron. But after talking with Tomas this morning, people seem to be a lot more at ease with this. Okay, so Cassie is a remnant that we all know about. This is another object where we look at properties of the remnant in order to say something about the progenitor. This is RxJ 1713. If you are on the Hess collaboration, this is the holy grail of particle acceleration. This is what we call a synchrotron-dominated remnant because up until a few years ago, we didn't detect any thermal X-ray emission. And because of that, because we didn't detect any thermal X-ray emission, we had postulated that the star exploded into a massive cavity that was carved out probably by an O-star wind. And now the blast wave is starting to interact with the wall. Okay, so that was a good theory, and that explained the lack of X-ray emission, but that actually puts constraints upon the progenitor as some sort of very massive star. Well, it turns out that Satoru Katsuda and his colleagues took all of the data that we have on this object, and they stacked it together, and they actually started detecting thermal X-ray emission. And what they found was that the abundances that they measure from this particular plot, this is the X-ray spectrum, if you're not familiar with these things, they found that the abundances were actually much more consistent with a low mass progenitor, and that the progenitor probably lost much of its mass through binary interaction. Okay, so this is another example of a star that exploded and that probably pretty low mass when it exploded. Now, this is interesting because we wrote a paper several years ago on this, and we tried to connect it to supernova 393, and we had argued that it was probably a low luminosity supernova, and that was inconsistent with it coming from a very massive star. But now that they seem to argue that it was a low luminosity event, that's probably consistent with what was observed by the Chinese. All right, so this is all well and good, but it takes a lot of effort to do this. You spend a lot of time and a lot of resources trying to basically drill down the parameters on a single object. What if instead you turn the question around and you said, what do supernova progenitors look like as supernova remnants? All right, so there's two ways to do this. Okay, you can either do a very expensive and detailed numerical simulation where you start at the point when the shock breaks out of the star and expand that out to the age of the remnant. That's very computationally expensive, and it's only recently been done with for Cassie in 1987A by a group in Palermo. The problem with this particular approach is that if any of the observational parameters change, then your very expensive three-dimensional model no longer matches the data. The other thing you can do is look at properties of supernova remnants as a class of objects and then compare them to the properties that you get from progenitors. All right, so what sort of properties are we thinking about? Well, we're interested in the age, that's important, and the size. These are dynamical things, and these are galactic objects for the most part, so we don't really know the size that well because we don't know the distance that well sometimes. There's no error bars on this, but they can be significant. Spectral qualities and quantities, include line centroids, so this is the iron K-line centroid, the line luminosity, how bright it is, and then basically also line ratios, and that's going to tell you something about the elemental composition. All right, so we can try this out. And this is an example, this is also a 1A example. It's a massive star workshop, but this is an example sort of proves that this sort of works. This is a project that Carlos and I did in 2012 on Kepler's supernova remnant. Now Kepler, if you're not familiar with it, it's thought to be expanding into the slow wind of an AGB star. So what we did was we took a couple of supernova 1A models, namely a subluminous model, a DDTG, and a DDTA model, and we expanded them out to the edge of Kepler in various wind configurations. And then we compared what the synthetic line centroids for iron, sulfur, and silicon were as a function of what we measured. And what we found is if we just assumed a pure wind, we don't get any match, we don't match the iron. And that's a pretty strong constraint. Basically, what we found is that the pure wind models end up over-ionizing the iron at an age of 400 years or so. So we argued that, well, this progenitor system probably went through some sort of fast outflow prior to it exploding. And when we include some sort of small artificial cavity, and I'll leave it to the stellar evolution people to tell us exactly how you can get a small cavity around this progenitor system, we actually were able to match the line centroids that we measure, which are these hatched regions again, with what we predict from the models. And we come up with reasonable mass loss rates for sort of an AGB companion to the Kepler supernova progenitor. So that works for one case. But what if we do it for, say, all sorts of models? Well, this is a plot of line energy, iron K line energy versus iron K line flux. And what I'm showing is these models right here are type 1A models, and they've been expanded out to ages of 500 to 1,000 years. These are models that were provided to us. Well, these are Carlos's models, but they got them from Bravo and his collaborators. And these are all core collapse models. So there's four here. There's two models that were provided by Alex Heger. And then there's a 1993 J model and an 87A model. And what you see is that there's a clear bifurcation between the core collapse models, what they predict for energy centroids, and what the 1A models predict. When you put the data down on top of it, you get the very consistent result. You find that core collapse remnants generally have higher line centroids than their 1A counterparts. Now, this isn't the whole story, though, because our models also predict the dynamics. So if you plot, say, the simulated radius as a function of line flux, you can also do this for line energy, you see that there's actually a very poor correlation between the simulated and the measured dynamics. So that